All right, welcome everyone to Figure Four Daily with Lance Storm and no Brian Alvarez. I'm recording this late Wednesday night. We were supposed to do our monthly-ish Q&A this week. It seems to be a cursed show. We've been trying to do it for a month or two now, and something always comes up, and something did come up. Brian had something he had to do with his kids and couldn't make our regular time. We were going to scrub the show altogether, and then texting back and forth, I just mentioned we should probably set up a mailbag so that I could do a solo Q&A show on those days that his schedule won't allow. And he responded with, if you want, I can send you some questions real quick. I'm like, sure, we could do that, I suppose. And real quick, turned out to be about 3 or 4 hours, which is why I'm doing this in the evening. And as an old guy, 9 o'clock at night is late. I've got a morning flight to Greensboro, North Carolina tomorrow for WrestleCade, Turning Point, Impact, TNA. TNA Wrestling's Turning Point event is Friday. So I'm traveling on Thanksgiving Day. So if you hear this in time and you're an American, please stay home and don't go to the Atlanta airport. I don't want to deal with Thanksgiving traffic, but I'm going to barrel on here and try to cover the few questions that Brian did send me. And then he can post this for audio. And I think he's going to just throw up a still photograph for the video version because too complicated for me to shoot a solo video show at home. So we will get right into the questions. There's not a ton of them. So I will either make some up at the end or try to be wordy when I can. First question. Does Lance have any old ECW shirts and can I have one? No, you can't. I think I might have like a couple t-shirts in a box in my basement. I got rid of almost all my stuff. There was a point where I was trying to collect one of everything, one of all my action figures, one of all my t-shirts, and I collected, you know, the Hardcore Cafe ECW shirt and some others that I had, but I quickly realized that I'm not a guy that's going to display any of this stuff anywhere, and my kids don't care, so it really just got to the point where it's just sitting in a box in my basement. What's the point? So many of the appearances I've done in Alberta or other places over the years, I've just taken it all and sold it or given it away. I think I might have a New Blood Rising t-shirt from WCW. I may have a Monday Night Jericho WCW shirt from his run, maybe. And there might be one other, but I got rid of all my action figures. I got rid of all my t-shirts. I'm not a collectible kind of guy. So actually, that's not true. I do have the original Green Tights ECW action figure. I have the one that we actually used to film the commercial. I know that because there's some clay stuck in the fingers of the action figure. for the commercial, they, you know, all the guys were there playing with their action figures, and they wanted Rob to have the RVD action figure Van Damme-nate mine, and the action figure wouldn't hold the damn chair. Why I remember this from, you know, 1999, I have no idea. 25 years, geez, or is it 35 years? Geez, no, 25. But so the guy that was shooting it had some clay, some putty or whatever, and mashed it into the hand so that the chair would stay put for the clip of Rob's action figure Van Damme-nating me. And since I'd never had an action figure and wasn't sure we would get another chance at having one, when they were done shooting, filming, and nobody seemed... Max, be quiet. No one seemed quick to pick up the stuff afterwards. I grabbed it quickly, threw it in my bag, and took it home. And I know I still have it because I was searching for stuff when we were doing the Chris Bay auction for TNA Wrestling to raise money for Chris Bay. I started digging through the pile of what I may or may not have left. And I don't know if they've done it yet because they didn't. They weren't going to do it at the auction. I think you were going to eBay it later, but I donated the Storm Wrestling Academy Championship belt that Tyler Breeze's class had given me as a gift at the end of the session. I checked with Breeze and I'm like, you get to speak for the class. Would anyone be offended if I donated this? And he quickly responded, no. And if they do, screw them. So I donated the belt. And then I also, I had the, and this is one thing I would have kept, but the WCW Canadian rule book from my WCW run with the Canadian title. So I donated both of those. And if they haven't been sold yet, they will be coming soon. So keep your eyes open. But yeah, I don't think I have an ECW t-shirt. And if I did, I wouldn't give it to you. Would Lance advise a new wrestler to take acting classes once they get the basics of wrestling down? I don't know if I would advise it. I certainly wouldn't advise against it. I actually remember, God, when was this? I don't know if I was still teaching WWE developmental or not. It was when Paul London was just starting out in WWE. And I remember he was off the main roster for some reason and wanted to take acting classes. And he was going to be off for a while, and they were like going to send him to developmental. And I don't know whether I mentioned it to Johnny or just to Danny Davis, but I was just like, this is ludicrous. It's like, if there's anything that you want to criticize Paul London for in whatever year that was, 2005 or whatever, I'm like, it's not his in-ring work. It's like, I would think WWE being character and personality driven would be far better benefited from Paul London taking acting classes and furthering his promo and acting skills than taking bumps in developmental. It's like, God, the guy's good enough in the ring. Why would he be here? So yeah, it certainly can't hurt, but Max, hey, sorry, just getting interrupted by my boy Max, who is not used to being up and about at this time, me doing a show. He's usually sleeping on the floor in the afternoon. Anyway, but yeah, certainly isn't going to hurt you, but I don't know if it's something that I would say you should go out of your way to do. Focus on the job and take your acting classes if you have the time. Alrighty. Did Lance tell his students about the price of fame? Wrestling fans, autograph seekers will hound wrestlers at airports and hotels. I would think most people that were getting into the business where I'm teaching them would know all these things. People who broke in, you know, especially the 2000s and on, had the benefit of the internet and shouldn't be caught off guard by some of the things that, like autograph seekers and so forth, where someone like myself who broke in pre-internet, because as I mentioned, I'm old, some of those things we may not have expected. Because you didn't have the access that people do now to hear wrestlers tell their stories and experiences of getting hounded at airports and so forth. So I would think many... Max, good gravy. Go lay down. Sorry, guys. My dog's being a pain in the butt. I would think most people now getting in, those are the kind of things that they want. That a lot of people get into this for the fame of it. So I wouldn't, something to Max, it wouldn't be something I'd go out of my way to mention. But a lot of stuff like that, it's like people will ask, you know, I've had students, you know, ask me specifically about maintaining a relationship in the wrestling business. And, you know, I'd sit down and talk to them, but it's like, it's not something I address with everyone. So if someone asked about, you know, how do you deal with stuff like that? It's like, well, you're as open and honest. Hang on one second, buddy. I'm going to let Max out of the room. Alrighty, he's gone, so hopefully we won't be interrupted anymore. But, yeah, the things you can... If anyone asked, I would advise them and give them my take on it. But when you're getting into a business that's televised, fame's one of the things you're probably looking for. Lance, who's the referee you dislike the most? Boy, I don't know if I can think of a bad referee that I worked with. Like, there was probably some crappy ones back when I first broke in. Because obviously when you're working dump indie shows, you have bad refs. But Mick McMichael and Diddy Gap, the two refs that I worked with in Europe, were fantastic. I learned so much from Mick. He was great. And Smoky Mountain had Brian Hildebrand, who was great. Mullineaux and, why am I blanking? Jim Mullineaux and, I can see his face. Why am I blanking? Anyway, hopefully it'll come to me or I'm going to feel like a dipshit. But the refs in ECW were great. WCW had good refs. I loved Charles Robinson. I know Brian always buries poor Nick Patrick, but I really enjoyed working with Nick. Nick was just one of those guys that, because I called a lot of matches in the ring on my own, on the fly, and there would be times where, you know, I bump and roll out of the ring, or we bump and we're separated from my opponent, and I realize I need to call something, and I'm not close enough to relay the message. And I think it's like, all right, where's my ref? And with Nick, every time I looked up, in one of those moments where I needed a ref, Nick was right there. I'm like, tell him to block my punch. And Nick would leave, and I'd get up and come charging with a punch, and my opponent would know he wanted to block it because Nick relayed the message for me. So they were good. All the guys in WWE are great. You know, I worked with Brian Heppner, Earl Heppner. Tim White was a great dude, although he got hurt shortly after I got there, so I didn't get to work with Tim as much as I would have liked. And, you know, Kyoto was great. Jimmy Cordero. So there was just great refs everywhere. I'm trying to think. No, I had a lot of good refs. I think the only one that I didn't see eye to eye with, David Putnam, refereed for CNWA, the took over for Stampede in Calgary on the weekly show. And he was Bob Brown's kid. And I hated Bob Brown. Just did not see eye to eye with the man. And didn't care for David Putnam all that much either. Because he would give a shit much like Bob would for reasons I didn't think were justified. But I was green, so I took it. So he might be my least favorite. But even that, he was fine as a ref. Alrighty, let's see. Going to the next ones here. Brian just sent me random screen caps, so I'm working my way through. Hi, Lance. I really enjoyed your matches with Chris Hero. Well, that's two of us. I was wondering if you have any memories to share about your matches with Hero. Yeah, God, I'm trying to think. There's the two that I remember most being in Ring of Honor, but then we also did one for, I don't even remember what the group was, to be honest, in Toronto, where he had terrible disastrous travel coming in. But the first ones, which again, I thought were the better ones because we had so much more prep and story and stuff leading into it, came about in a weird way in that, again, once I had my school and was no longer working for WWE, it would have been Gabe Sapolsky, who was with Ring of Honor, reached out and asked if he sent me DVDs, if I'd be willing to send him feedback, advice, critiques, and so forth. And he's like, anything, you know, lighting, commentary, booking, matches, anything. Because he just wanted to improve and would like to hear my opinions. I'm like, sure, send them away. So he sent me a couple of DVDs, and I know the first email I sent back, I had tons of notes and stuff because I'm a crazy detail guy. And he was like, oh man, this is great. Would you mind if I, you know, sent this to the talent? They, you know, they might appreciate it. I think there was one guy I was a little harsh. I'm like, delete that out. I was a bit more harsh because I wasn't really expecting them to read it. No need to mention who it was. I'm not even sure now, actually, I think about it. But anyway, so he had sent it on, and I started doing this on a regular basis, and some of the guys I'd never hear from, but others would respond back and thank me or ask questions or debate points and stuff. And Chris was one of the ones that I had some harsh critiques for. This was when he was, you know, he had the superhero logo and the bodysuit and was doing a lot of comedy. And I thought he could be a really solid, serious, higher on the card worker. And him, along with Kevin Steen, was another one who, you know, took critique well. And I thought, so anyway, I really enjoyed working with all of them. And I would give, you know, Chris a lot of feedback and he would respond. And then there was the weekend in Toronto. And they reached out for me to do an appearance in Ring of Honor. I think I was just going to do a signing at first, but then they got Brett, to do a signing. And it was funny when he called me, he was trying to find a polite way of saying that since we have Bret Hart as a signing, we don't really need you. We've got a bigger name. Maybe if you still want to come, would you be willing to wrestle or be more involved? And I think I beat him to the punch and echoed his thoughts for him ahead of time. Because if you're not going to attend a Ring of Honor show for a Bret Hart signing, I can't imagine there's too many people that will show up for the Lance Storm one. So I ended up agreeing that I'd come in and I'd work. And I think they originally offered me a tag against Jimmy Jacobs and Tyler Black, the now Seth Rollins. And in hindsight, I probably would have really enjoyed Seth Rollins, but I had done so much more coaching and interacting with Chris Hero that I suggested him because Chris had really earned my respect and I thought he was really good. So I suggested him, and I think I had done a signing the previous time they were in Toronto and then went down to a pay-per-view in Detroit and did an angle with Larry Sweeney and Sweet and Sour Incorporated, which Hero was a part of. And they had actually laid me out at the pay-per-view. So it's sort of, well, there's a bit of an angle and a story. We could do the Hero match. Cornette, I believe, was the actual booker at the time. And he pitched to me, if you'll work both nights, we could do a tag the first, which we did. It was me and Kevin Steen, Kevin Owens, for those who don't make the connection, against Hero and Davey Richards, and then a single the second night with me and Hero. And Cornette had suggested that if I put over Hero in the tag, I could then go over in the single. And I said, I'll do those matches, but I would rather go over in the tag and actually put Hero over in the single. Because he's going to be staying in Ring of Honor and far more valuable moving forward than me, who's not going to be there. Cornette thought that was a fantastic idea and jumped at it. So we did. And we did the tag the first night, which I really enjoyed. Davey Richards is one of those people that most people probably don't realize I actually had a match with, but we did have a tag. Kevin and I had a lot of fun. And then the last night was the match with Hero, which I really enjoyed, thought it was great. Chris is phenomenal and his elbows are incredible. He's probably the only guy in the world I would let blindly elbow me in the back of the head. He's that good. But I remember, too, when, you know, we got there, and I guess it's Cornette probably dealing with a lot of older veterans that are protective, but, you know, they pitched. It's like, all right, well, you can do the match and put Chris Hero over, and then, you know, to give a pop for the house and stuff and save face, you know, he could go to beat you up again afterwards, and you could counter it and super kick him and, you know, rah, 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 leave with your hand held high. And I remember telling Cornette, I'm like, well, the whole point is I'm trying to put the guy over. It's like, I'm not coming back. I don't need my head held high at the end. How about he just knocks me the hell out, beats me, stands over me, and gets something out of this? And he's like, okay, great. So that's what we did. It was also, and I think it played well into realism in the match, but I wasn't working a lot. I was teaching at the school, and I would, you know, the last so many weeks of camp, I would do a lot of cardio and do wrestling matches with all my students to get into shape. And like my whole career, I never rolled my ankle. I got really good at not rolling my ankle after playing basketball and volleyball for so many years. And 2 weeks before that match, I rolled my ankle in class throwing a chop. Like, how could you? I just stepped to throw a chop and somehow misplaced my foot and rolled my ankle bad. So my last 2 weeks of hard cardio to prepare turned into 2 weeks of no cardio to prepare. And I was feeling it. I think probably showing it too. But again, I thought it at least played into the story of the old retired guy coming back to fight the younger guy. Me not having the same level of cardio played into a realistic match. And again, Chris was phenomenal. I really enjoyed that match a lot. We did one later in Toronto for someone. I don't remember exactly who. It was probably like the BSE guys I worked with years for earlier, but different name for a company. And that one was a disaster in that Chris had his rental car in New Jersey broken into the night before the show. He was supposed to fly in, and I believe they stole his passport. So he's like, I can't fly in. But as the pro that wants to make his bookings decided he could drive to the border and try to talk his way through with his driver's license, somehow managed to. And he literally got to the show 10 minutes before we went to the ring. So we really just winged it and called it out there. And so in that regard, it was a lot of fun. There was a lot more different grappling because Hero's a student of the game, if you will, and knows damn near everything. So we did a lot of weird things that wouldn't necessarily have planned out ahead of time, but that was a lot of fun too. So those are my memories of wrestling with Chris Hero. But yeah, the single from Toronto, I have very fond memories of, so I would highly recommend you check that one out. Lance, if there is a move you could ban, which move would that be and why? I think I've told the story on the show with Brian before. When WWE in the, 2003, 2004 was bringing up a lot of guys from OVW, green guys. And they were also on the kick of banning moves. And I remember at one point yelling at one of the people in creative that we don't need to ban moves, we need to ban shitty workers. That I would take a million moves from David Finley before I would take a snapmare from some of these people. Case in point, you might think banning elbowing people unprotected in the back of the head would be an important thing to be safe, but if you're getting hit by a Chris Hero, you're perfectly safe anyway. And similarly, if you're taking a move from Fit Finley, with the possible exception of the kick in the back, you're perfectly fine. And even then, it's just a little snug. But there's a few moves that have a higher risk of concussion that I think you could certainly consider. The razor's edge, unless you're really good at it. And I thought Scott Hall was actually very safe with it, but I know there was many others that did the razor's edge that caused a lot of concussions. Just that there's a lot of horizontal movement when you hit the mat, which triggers the neck snap and banging your head. The sunset flip powerbomb out of the corner, has concussed a boatload of people. And I don't know if it's worth the times that you don't for the risk of the times that you do bang your head. That would be one I think we just don't need. And really, if you just sunset flip, land on your feet, and carried him out and gave him a regular power bomb, the chance of banging your head goes down so much. I think that would be a worthy compromise. And again, it's the same thing of when you're pulling him out of the corner. It's the horizontal movement that when you land, your head keeps going. And it's that horizontal movement towards your head when you bump. Go watch Heatwave 98, the match with Candido and I. We had done the powerbomb off the top many, many times. And for some reason in that match, he kind of gave me an extra push out of the corner, giving me that horizontal movement. And I land on my ass, and then I land on my back, and then my head bounces like a basketball. And while I wasn't diagnosed with a concussion and didn't suffer concussion symptoms, I can't for the life of me imagine I didn't get one. So those would be at the top of my list. I think the other, not that it seems like banning it, but I'd want to have a crash pad and have the guy prove to me that he's good enough to do it. The Kali Tree Slam. When you get picked up and paused like that, you have no more control of your body. It's all on him. And again, if he over-rotates you, you land on your head and neck. If he under-rotates you, you land on your ass and whiplash and smash your head. To me, that's a move that, again, the the juice isn't worth the squeeze, if I can borrow a phrase. So those would certainly be ones that I would consider. But again, I'm more find the people that are good and safe at things and let them do it, and make sure that qualified people are doing the more dangerous moves. I'm just realizing, looking at my record things here, that I didn't actually dig out my compressor. Hopefully Brian can compress the audio if need be. I'm used to recording where it's transferred via the internet and gets compressed on his end already. So the audio may be a little more up and down. Hopefully he can fix it, or hopefully you can tolerate it. Let's see, what else do we have here? In the spirit of American Thanksgiving, a two-part question. Does Lance's anti-gravy agenda extend to all gravy equally? Was he always a communist, or just pursuing extraordinary healthy lifestyle? Happy American Thanksgiving to everyone in the empire. The anti-gravy agenda is still in full force. I'm not a gravy guy. It's something that I didn't do because I was trying to stay in shape. I don't think I ever really was, even before I decided to wrestle in my underwear on national television. But when you're watching your diet, gravy and butter and such things are not necessities. So I avoided them. And when you avoid them for a few decades, you it's no longer something you crave or are really interested in. So it's something I still don't bother with. It's not something that I expect, not something I crave, so it's something I avoid. There's been a lot of desserts over the years that I avoided trying, because it's like, well, if I really like them, it's just another thing I have to try to not eat. Where if I don't know that I like it, it's pretty easy to avoid. So gravy is still a no-go for me. Alrighty, let's see here. Further down in the text thread that he sent me. I'm doing well, almost at a half an hour. What's the best and the worst thing, besides the cold, about doing those Tony Candelo Northern death tours? And how hard do these compare to international tours? Well, it was the hardest tour I ever did. It would be easier now, in that food that you can take with you is a lot better than it was in 1995 when I did the tour. And having internet and cell phones and an iPad and stuff that you could take movies and books and things with you at a lot easier rate would make it a much easier trip. But yeah, weather and the travel was the worst thing. You know, you're talking February in northern Manitoba. And again, I don't know the exact number. My joke was always 15 people in a 12-passenger van, but a bunch of us crammed into a big van where, you know, shoulder to shoulder on bench seats. For, again, I think the first drive to our first, like we left Winnipeg and went to Oxford House, like I think it was a 12-hour drive. So just 12 hours sitting shoulder to shoulder in a van with Tony Candelo in the front seat chain smoking. Is a rough go. And again, if you had Netflix on your iPad or some movies downloaded and so forth, it would be a lot easier. But we sat in a van and drove that far. And when you get there, you know, it's that cold outside and no hotels. We're sleeping on, you know, gymnastics mats and like just the thin, like the blue mats around the ring, basically. I think there was one school that had like the high jump pit that was the luxury apartment, if you will. I think I just shared a photo, but again, you know, we're bringing a sleeping bag with us and a bag, you know, a bag with cans of tuna and instant oatmeal and stuff like that with us for food. And we stayed in the high schools that we performed the wrestling shows in. We would sleep on the floors in the gym, use the change room, showers, and bathrooms in the gym, and we would use the home ec rooms to cook our fancy meals, which again was a lot of tuna, some pasta, and instant oatmeal and things that were easy, you know, cans of baked beans and stuff that you could cook up easy in a home ec room. So I would imagine there'd be a lot more better food that you could take with you nowadays, better entertainment that you could take with you nowadays, but doing 12 to 20 hours of driving on winter roads, which are, you know, plowed trails across frozen lakes where they pump water up onto the road to continue it to freeze to make it thicker so you can drive on it, you're out in the middle of nowhere. And we had no communication whatsoever. And we're, you know, middle of the night driving across frozen lakes with no one around, no one in sight, no cell phones, no communication of any kind. It's like the van broke down. We probably all would have died. So it was a very remote, crazy tour. Now, the upside was I had friends with me, and horrible tours produce the best stories. And it was me and Don Callis, Luther, who's in AAW now, Len, he was on the tour with us, Edge, Adam Copeland, he was Adam Impact on that tour, he was on it, who else was, Johnny Swinger was on that tour, Joe Legend, I wonder what he's up to now, I think he might live in Germany or something, but Joe Legend was on that tour, and actually Jethro Hogg was on that tour, he had a potbelly pig he brought with him. I've told the story on shows with Brian before of the pig ribs and the different things we did. Actually, throwback, one of the worst refs I ever worked with was Tony Condello. Because on the death tour, our one referee, Llama Face, as Don used to call him, had to go home for some reason. Probably to maintain his mental health and sanity. So Tony went home, Llama Face went home, and it's possible this was one of the fly-ins in the summer we did in Northern Ontario. It may not have actually been Death Tour. I'm not sure which. I think it was Death Tour. No, absolutely was, because I've got photos. Anyway, I always worked with Don, the natural back then. And when Tony became the referee, we all decided we were going to rib Tony. Len Luther was the king of ribs. And so at one point he, lined the inside of Tony's sweatpants with, you know, A535, a heat rub. Tony's, pants would be on fire and he would be sweating his bag off literally. But for the one match, actually the whole show, we decided the boys as a group decided we're going to pants Tony, the ref. And again, Tony is I don't know how old he was at the time, seemed old, probably like my age now, but he was not the best ref. But we decided as a challenge to see who could pants Tony during the match. And I think Len snipped the drawstring in his sweats, and Tony saw the drawstring was gone, so I think he knew the fix was in. So everyone kept trying, and it's like, you know, they do a spot and they crawl over and they try to pull. And Tony always managed to grab his waist and keep his pants on. And Len, the diabolical genius Luther, in what I would consider one of the bigger pops of the tour. Actually, Paul Lazenby was on that tour too. where was I? Oh, yeah. I think he might have been working Paul. I think Paul was giving him... I'm hoping you guys know who Paul Lazenby is. He was an indie worker. He did a lot of MMA fighting. He's now does stunt work and stuff. Seems to know everybody in the business. And I kind of like, how do you know all these people? Paul's doing the 10 punches in the corner to Len. And after the 10 punch, Paul jumps down and Len staggers out. And just as he's doing the classic flare flop face bump, he does it right before Tony. And as he's going down, rather than catch himself on the bump, he reaches out with his hands real quick and just pinches Tony's sweats and manages to do the flare bump and take Tony's pants right to the floor with him on the bump. And then Tony had to scramble as he's in his tighty-whities in the ring in front of everyone. We had fun with Tony as a ref, but he was a wretched referee. Again, fun times. Yeah, I don't remember the town that we did the pantsing thing in, but that was the same tour, because I've got photos, which Paul took, of Death Tour. And there's photos of the Night of the Pig Rib, and there's photos of Len smearing the heat rub in Tony's sweats. So it would have been that tour that we also pantsed him. So that was the Death Tour, and the crappy refereeing of Tony. I guess you could also say that the tour was bad, because A, you didn't make a lot of money, but there was the shows were, and I'm doing air quotes here, guaranteed. But because the northern communities, First Nations communities that we're doing these shows at, if there's a death in the community, it's a really big deal. And the entire community shuts down and mourns the community member they lost. So that's sort of the thing in Tony's contract, is that the shows are guaranteed, they will happen unless there's a death. And that very first night after we did the 12, 20 hours, whatever it was, to get us to Oxford House, we pull up to the band office and Tony goes in and he comes out and says, ah, God damn, it was a death. And the shows are canceled, and we're supposed to do two shows. And the thing is, as I mentioned, there's no hotels, and there's nowhere you can go. Like, these are remote, remote communities, and we're just going to, you know, puddle jump from community to community. So the next community doesn't expect us for, you know, 3 days, because we've got two shows here. And they let us stay in the school, because the schools are shut down for the funeral. So we stayed in the Oxford House school gym for 2 days with no shows. I remember Don managed to procure, I don't know whether Len broke into or what, but they got into an audiovisual room and got a TV and a VCR, because again, this was 1995, and Don had some old VHS tapes of some of Tony Vision programs, so we watched that, and we played basketball in the gym, but we sat around for 2 days that we weren't going to get paid for after driving a dozen hours to get there. And then after the 2 days, it's like, see ya, we got to go to the next town. So then we drove the next one. And the way it worked, I think, like, we went up one side of Lake Winnipeg one time and up another the other. So after we did the first five or six shows, we were going to have a couple of days off before we hit the last five or six shows. And Tony managed to rebook back in Oxford House. So rather than having a couple days off, we trekked all those, you know, dozen hours back into Oxford House to do those shows. So travel was horrible. Weather was horrible. Money wasn't great, but the company was. So yeah, those were some shows. But yeah, no restaurants, no hotels, no television, no internet. Just the joys of good friends, I guess. So that's the Death Tour shenanigans of... I went in 1995. Don went in 1994. Len did that one with him as well. Don actually, I have it somewhere. He has some video footage, not of the matches, but when they were in the band office, they had their own television broadcast up there. And so Tony and all the boys, when they got there the day before the show or the morning before the show, went into the band office and broadcast on their local television, basically just given a live mic and had a camera pointing into the room. And it's hilarious because zero preparation, just Tony walks, oh, hey, everybody, it's Tony Gandello, WFWA Wrestling. And he would start introducing, oh, and then we got the natural, he's the champ, and he's going to be fighting with Steve Reeves. And it's like, it wasn't Steve Reeves, it was Steve Rivers. But Tony screwed up everybody's name. And you can see the guys sitting in the background, random people walking behind them. And when the boys are on a horrible tour, and they're not afraid of the promoter firing them, they tend to entertain themselves. So these promos and shenanigans that were on this tape were unbelievably hilarious. Some really top-notch, just comical, goofy stuff. And similarly, I think it was just radio. I don't think we had television. I remember I did them. I don't know if it was 95 or whether it was when we did the fly-ins, but we did some radio or television up there. And that's when Tony, in his mumbling Tony language, described Adam Impact, Edge, as a circle lurker dude. And we're like, what the hell is a circle lurker dude? And it was a surfer looking dude, he was trying to say. And still to this day, on occasion, Edge and I will joke and mention the circle lurker dude. He also, Paul Lazenby, if you don't, he's a, again, if you don't know who he is, I've described what he does, but he's a big, strong, scary dude. He did powerlifting and other stuff. And Tony, in his infinite wisdom, decided to introduce him to the people of whatever community we're in at the time as a Vietnam veteran. Paul's younger than me, a little young to be in Vietnam. And I think Paul even comes in and says, yeah, I served in Vietnam when I was 3. And but that's Tony. He just said whatever, and we went with it. And we used to challenge Len to work derogatory or obscene things into his promo, and Len always rose to the occasion and pulled it off. We entertained ourselves. I wonder if Don has some of the audio of that, but classic stuff. And yeah, the worst trips produce the best stories, much like my Lebanon tour. When you just have an easy travel and a good show when you come home, you don't really have the stories. So that's the upside to death tour. Looks like I'm not going to have to make up my own questions. I managed to ramble on and talk enough. We're a little over 40 minutes in now, and I've got a few plugs to throw out. So I'm going to wrap up. Brian and I will hopefully be back next week. We were going to have to find a new time slot in the new year because Brian's doing After Dark Radio on Sports Byline. And I guess the time slot they had for him on Sports Byline is our usual 3 o'clock Pacific on Wednesdays. So Brian and I will be shifting our regular show time in the new year. But for plugs before I go, Escaping Denver, the scripted podcast that I do a little bit of voice work for, season 4 is out wherever you get your podcasts. Feel free to binge season 1, 2, and 3. But this past month, it drops new every Monday. This past Monday was basically the very last line of the episode was my return. I am the archivist. But I know the next couple of episodes are Lance Storm heavy, I guess archivist heavy. But it's a really interesting scripted podcast. If you are into some conspiracy theories and so forth, this is, and again, more fun conspiracies about like the Bigfoot, Sasquatch, aliens, shadow governments, and the all of the goings-on secret structures below the Denver airport. Anyway, give it a check out. It's a lot of fun. And then, obviously, Impact Wrestling. We have a special Thanksgiving episode, which will air tomorrow, Access TV in the U.S., Fight Network in Canada. But Friday, from WrestleCade in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Friday night, Turning Point. Let me just see if I can run a few of these matches by in my head here. Nick Nemeth defending the TNA World title against Eddie Edwards. Masha Slamovich is defending the Women's World title, the Knockouts World title, against Jordan Grace in a 2 out of 3 falls match. And if you happen to have saw their last one at, I think it was Bound for Glory, which was just incredible, you get to see potentially 3 more falls of that. So that should be exciting. There is the throwback tradition of the Turkey Bowl match with the turkey suit. I think it's 6 people. The winner, I think, gets a title shot. Don't quote me on that. And the loser has to wear the turkey suit. And in that is Joe Hendry, Eric Young, I think Hammerstone, John Schuyler, and PCO. I may have missed someone. There's other matches as well. There is Josh Alexander versus Steve Maclin in a no DQ match. So those are the highlights. There's more. Check at TNA Wrestling on Threads and Blue Sky and probably X and wherever else they may be for the rest of the lineup. But yeah, Turning Point on Friday night. If you're in Winston-Salem for WrestleCade, would love to see you come out. I'm not doing any signings or appearances, but if you happen to catch me somewhere, feel free to say hi. But yeah, Impact Wrestling, TNA Wrestling Impact is tomorrow night. And Turning Point on Friday. So, yeah, that's going to be it for this week. Thanks for the questions. And maybe Brian will actually get a proper mailbag put together at some point so we can field more. So thanks, everybody. And we'll talk to you again after a while.